When people have a new idea inside of a large organization, what will happen is they'll say, typically the question they'll receive very early on is, how big is your idea? What's the market opportunity? Size the market for me. This is the typical framework, right? Basically, predict the size of the opportunity because, look, we're a big company. We have $1 billion in revenue. If this is not a $500 million idea or a $50 million idea, whatever the number is, it won't move the needle. Right? It won't move the needle, therefore we're not interested. Now, what's the flaw in that reasoning? The flaw in that reasoning is that if it's a really original idea and it's really early on, the likelihood that this innovator will be able to accurately predict the size of the market is very, very low.
Hi there, guys. Today we are joined all the way from a little area called Smithfield outside of Boston by Michael Roberto, actually Professor Michael Roberto. He is the Trustee Professor of Management and Director of the Center for Program Innovation at Bryant University. He has joined that faculty at Bryant University for the past 15 years, and for the last 6 years, he's been a member of the faculty at the Harvard Business School. Professor Roberto has published his newest book, Unlocking Creativity, and he has written two previous books, Why Great Leaders Don't Take Yes for an Answer, and Know What You Don't Know, published back in 2009. Professor Roberto has taught in the leadership development programs and consulted to a number of firms, including Mars, Deloitte, Google, Target, Apple, FedEx, Disney, Morgan Stanley, IBM, Walmart, Amica, and Textron, just to name a few. He's also presented at numerous government organizations, including the FBI, NASA, Joint Special Operations Command, the Air War College, and West Point. And over the last 15 years, Professor Roberto has served on the faculty at the Nomura School of Advanced Management in Tokyo, where he teaches in the executive program each summer. So I'm really privileged to bring Professor Michael Roberto to you today. We're going to unpack in this episode the idea of creativity and business performance. There is a documented series of evidence in terms of the relationship between creativity and business performance. If you think about Apple, if you think about, some of the world's most successful, commercially successful companies, innovation is not a nice to have. It is an essential requirement to business success. Now, innovation is something that companies love to talk about, but very few companies actually get it right. And in Michael's latest book called Unlocking Creativity, How to Solve Any Business Problem and Make the Best Decisions by Shifting Creative Mindsets, we unpack the meat and the potatoes all in this area. So, a few things that really stood out for me was Michael's view on what we call the sort of C3s, which is certainty, compliance, and control, and how we gravitate as leaders in the business environment towards those three things and how that constrains innovation. We also unpack the creative mindset and how to foster creative mindsets within your people. We also share some very interesting insights into Disney stores worldwide, and specifically a webinar that Michael hosted with Jim Fielding, who is the former president of Disney Stores Worldwide, and how Disney is innovating to really take a kind of a really household brand into the future. We also unpack Apple, arguably one of the world's most creative companies, but what has actually happened there since, you know, well-known innovations like the iPhone. We also share some views on why senior leaders claim to value creativity, yet often lack the knowledge to provide a creative framework, and pay careful attention there, guys, to the creative framework that he shares around innovation and how you can take new, innovative, sustainable products to market quicker than you ever have before. And being an educator, obviously, I did get into the educational space with Michael, obviously with COVID-19 driving a lot of students to online learning platforms, and parents, especially in the US, not being prepared to pay Harvard fees anymore necessarily for four-year tuitional programs. What does the future of education look like? And what has he learned on the principles around effective teaching and learning today? And what can we learn as entrepreneurs and business leaders in applying effective teaching principles in the context of innovation and creativity? So much more to get in, guys. Oh, and one more thing. He does share a very interesting story about two Harvard students who have started a rental dress company. if you can believe that. And remember, guys, if you would like to join the conversation, please do. You can tweet me at MattBrownZA, or you can drop me a mail at hello@mattbrownshow.com. So without further ado, enter Professor Michael Roberto.
Hi, Matt. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, likewise, likewise. So thank you so much for being here. I've been doing a lot of research, as I do on all my guests, and we're going to talk about your book, which I'm going to bring up on screen for everybody. So this is called Unlocking Creativity, How to Solve Any Problem and Make the Best Decisions by Shifting Creative Mindset. So I think straight off the bat, there's a lot I want to get into and unpack with you today, specifically in the context of, you know, entrepreneurs solving problems all the time and looking for new ways to solve old problems. And obviously the saying goes, you know, you can't solve the can't solve a problem with the same point of view that created it in the first place. So lots to get into today. But for our listeners and viewers all around the world, Michael, who potentially haven't heard about the amazing work that you're doing at Harvard and engaging with kids and all sorts of rad stuff, why don't you give us the elevator pitch? What do we need to know? Kick us off.
Sure. So, you know, I'm a professor at a school called Bryant University, which is on the East Coast of the United States in the Northeast in the state of Rhode Island. I've been here for 15 years. Before that, I was a professor and at Harvard Business School, and I did my undergraduate and graduate work there as well. And I've been studying how people solve problems and make decisions for many years. And this book's really about creative problem solving and what gets in the way of our ability to actually generate creative solutions to what you might call wicked problems that our organizations face.
What are some, well, maybe we can get into the mindset first, because it's something that I preach to my my staff all the time. And just this morning I was talking to my sales guys about mindsets and how if you want to create amazing results, start with your mindset and then you can figure out the rest. But if you don't have a great mindset, very unlikely or improbable that you might get, you know, incredible results. So maybe let's dive into the mindset piece to start off with. I mean, in your expert opinion, Professor, what or how do you define a creative mindset?
Basically, look at, you know, just to step back, I was trying to understand what is inhibiting creativity and innovation in organizations. And my argument is, yes, we hear things like bureaucracy, hierarchy, you know, short-term financial expectations, you know, these kinds of things do get in the way. But I argue that mindset or mental models, ways of thinking about innovation and creativity actually get in the way. And so, you know, my basic argument is that some of these mindsets about the way we think that great new original ideas are created and implemented, they're ill-founded. They're not correct. And those mindsets are what get in the way in many regards. So just to give you an example, I talk about I kick off the book talking about the linear mindset. You know, many of us trained, right, as managers and running businesses, we are sort of trained to think pretty linearly. We analyze and research a problem. We develop a plan. We execute the plan, right? So it's a very linear process. But in fact, you know, I make the argument that most creativity and most innovation is really fundamentally nonlinear. It's much more about test and learn, you know, iterating quickly. And that runs counter to sort of our training. And it runs counter to our desire for control, right? We like the idea of having a plan that's well thought out and that leads to careful execution. But in fact, you know, as Mike Tyson, the notorious boxer, once said, everybody's got a plan until I punch him in the mouth, right? I mean, in an unpredictable, turbulent world, the notion that we can somehow sit in a room and concoct the perfect plan without going out into the market, testing our ideas, listening to customers, iterating quickly, experimenting, it's just not likely. So that mindset, that linear mindset, I think is foundational in many of our training, our upbringing as managers, but it gets in the way.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, you can always make the point that, you know, we're living now in an exponential world, but we've been almost indoctrined to think in a linear fashion, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And meanwhile, the numbers don't make sense in an exponential business environment, especially with, you know, exponential tech like artificial intelligence and all this kind of stuff. And I've tried to, at a previous opportunity, I was working for a major company as head of innovation prior to this, you know, new journey that I'm on. And what I've observed is that innovation's a hard sell. As a lot of companies like to talk about innovation, but to do it is an entirely different thing. Especially when you have shareholders and, you know, you obviously have to focus on, you know, your shareholder value. But I think as humans, though, we tend to gravitate towards certainty. We seek certainty over uncertainty. And maybe mindset has a role to play there. Do you have a view on that?
Yes. I like to say that managers, there's a bit of double talk when it comes to creativity and innovation, right? So they say they want creativity. In fact, for example, IBM did a massive study of chief executives around the world where they cited creativity as what they thought was going to be one of the fundamentally important leadership traits moving forward. And yet I say, while they say they want creativity, their behavior, many leaders' behaviors really suggest what they want is certainty, compliance, and control, right? That's what they want. They want a very predictable environment. And so this is the tension, right? And in fact, there's some research by Jennifer Muller, for example, has done some great work showing that people who are viewed as highly creative, they sometimes get penalized in terms of their career progression in organizations because they're a bit unorthodox, because they challenge conventional wisdom. It's not always a good thing to be perceived as creative in a lot of large organizations.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey there. I know being an entrepreneur can be a very lonely experience. You sometimes get stuck, don't you? Well, if you're like me, being stuck sucks. But what if you could access the minds of over 850 CEOs who have built companies generating billions of dollars in revenue and access all of that knowledge in a fraction of a second? Well, the good news is you can literally do that today. What my team have built is Matt Brown AI. It is trained on all the interviews, over 850 of them that I've done to date, all my books, all the knowledge capital that has been generated over the last 10 years right here on the Matt Brown Show. And you can get access to all of that right now for free. So how do you get access to this? Well, head on over to mattbrownshow.com and at the top, you'll see community. Hit that link, sign up. It's absolutely free and you'll be given instant access to Matt Brown AI and a community of over 100,000 subscribers. It isn't, or disruptive. You know, you don't want to be the one that wants to do things in a new way because, you know, to your point around, you know, we're seeking certainty, compliance, and control. We don't like, you know, going up against the grain in order to create new commercial value, if you like.
And this goes back, by the way, to, you know, this goes back to the way we're taught in school, right? As young children. I mean, there's actually some research that shows that teachers behave sort of the same way as CEOs. They too will tell you they want creativity. But in fact, and I will include myself and many of my professor colleagues, we say we want creativity, and yet we too want compliance and control in the classroom, right? We want people to do what we say, you know? And so this is a tension, not just in large businesses. I think it's a tension in starting with the way we're educated.
Yeah. So the creative mindset, how does one develop a creative mindset to solve complex business problems? So obviously, you being a professor at Bryant University and you engaging with students, I mean, what do you tell them on the front line today about, you know, developing this kind of creative mindset?
Well, one of the things I talk about is the fact that, you know, in far too many organizations, what we see is imitation instead of innovation. Right, we're trained to go out there and benchmark against the competition, understand what they're doing, look for best practices. But a lot of that's leading to copycat behavior, right? We're just copying what others are doing. But fundamentally, winning in the marketplace is about standing out, being different from the competition, right? And so this mindset you have to adopt is one of saying, I'm not going to simply benchmark, identify best practices and imitate. I've got to find a different way. Now, how do you do that? One of the things I suggest is you've got to find ways to kind of broaden your perspective. One great way is looking outside your industry for inspiration. You know, we call this analogous inspiration. You know, so suppose you want to be really good at customer service, right? You've got a competitor who's better than you at customer service. Say, well, how can I innovate the customer experience? Well, suppose you're in, you know, whatever business you're in, you could go out and study that competitor really closely. But at the end of the day, you may end up fixating on what they do and just copying them. Instead, you could say, well, wait, who in the world is world-class at customer experience, right? Disney, the Ritz-Carlton. Go study them. Go get inspired by what somebody's doing in a totally different business. And that will broaden your mind in a way, right? And so this is really important in terms of creative mindsets, the ability to go outside of your sort of regular routine. Novelty stirs the brain is my argument, right? And reaching outside can be, you're not going to, because you can never copy what Disney does, because let's say you're in a totally different business. Maybe you're in the grocery business, right? But you can learn some principles from Disney and then say, how might I translate those to my business, right? And so by definition, you're going to innovate because you can't imitate because they're doing something fundamentally different, but you can learn a lot from them.
Absolutely. And one of the things I observed on your Twitter was that you had Jim Fielding, the president of Disney Stores Worldwide, visiting one of your strategy classes today. And you went on to say, you know, very fascinating discussion with some great stories. And I actually was going to ask you to share some real world examples, right? Because I think it's a theory is one thing, but who's actually doing this, you know, practically applying, you know, creative approaches to solving complex problems. So what did you observe or discuss in the context of Disney specifically?
It was a great guy. I've known Jim for a number of years, and Jim used to run Disney Stores many years ago. And as you've seen from the headlines, Disney Stores are struggling today. So I said, hey, Jim, I know you left Disney some years ago. Would you come talk about, you know, the work you did and the like? And it was fascinating, right? Because Jim talked about back when he took over Disney Stores and they were struggling then. And he kind of made a major shift in their strategy. And he talked about having to pitch to the board, including Steve Jobs, who was his, you know, most ardent questioner when he was there. And Jim talked about really thinking about, well, okay, so if we're just selling the same goods that people can buy down the street at Target and Walmart, then, you know, he said, Steve Jobs asked him, then why do Disney Stores exist? Right? You have to be creating some value that makes you such that the customer wants to come to the store. Otherwise, they can just get the product on Amazon or at Walmart or Target. So it made him think about, oh, okay, so it's not about the goods. It's about the experience, right? It's about how the customer feels. And we have to innovate on that because that's what's going to make this a special thing. And how do we contribute to the broader strategy of Disney, right? How do the stores enhance the value of the theme parks, the movies, other businesses? And that was his vision of what he wanted to do when he was running it, you know, a number of years ago. So I think it was a great start. I'll give you another example of a company that I often use to talk about what it means to have a different mindset. So I often say to my students and to executives I talk to, so imagine we're playing Shark Tank and, you know, you're a shark and I'm pitching to you as an entrepreneur. And imagine I say to you that I'm going to pitch to you a totally new different kind of grocery store, one where there's nothing ever on sale, when there are almost no branded goods, when there's no loyalty card, we don't accept coupons, we've really cramped aisles and cramped parking lots. We have a very limited selection. We don't do any television advertising. We have virtually no social media, no self-checkout. Would you like to come to my, would you like to invest in my grocery store? And people chuckle and go, that sounds ridiculous. What kind of store is that? I said, oh, that's Trader Joe's, the most successful grocery store on earth. It's an American chain owned by the German parent company, Aldi. And it's a wildly successful store. What have they reinvented? Well, they're this small format store that has created this amazing customer experience. They have passionate fans who line up, you know, at 3 o'clock in the morning when a new store opens. It's incredible, right? Well, what they've done is reinvent the grocery store. They've made it a really pleasant experience in a way. They've realized, you know, that they don't need to do a lot of the things that traditionally grocery stores do, but what they do is create something really unique. So it's that ability to shed the conventional wisdom that's really powerful.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was listening. I follow Scott Galloway. I don't know if you know if you're familiar with his work.
Sure, sure.
So Scott has a really great newsletter, which I highly recommend people subscribe to. It's No Mercy, No Malice, and he spoke about Disney, and maybe there's something we can double down on here, specifically within the Disney context, because he was talking about Disney and its sort of lackluster commercial growth. And you mentioned, of course, that stores are in trouble. And if you then, you know, tie that back to what we're talking about, which is, you know, creative approaches to complex business problems. Now, Disney's complex, right? It's not a simple business. There's lots of moving parts. There's retail and you know, movies and all sorts of cool things, theme parks, etc. And Scott was describing an opportunity that he sees for Disney, which is to move into a subscription play. So for instance, you know, you pay one monthly subscription, but you can go to any number of theme parks. You can get access to all the different value propositions across all the different types of, you know, subsidiaries, if you like, within Disney. Is that a good example of creative approaches to complex business problems? So like if Disney did go to subscriptions?
Well, it might be. I mean, I think the issue with Disney, I mean, if you look historically, they really were struggling in the late 70s, early 80s. And then Michael Eisner came in and there was a decade of tremendous performance, right? Reinvigorating the brand in lots of ways. Then there was sort of a lackluster decade. And then Bob Iger took over and there was a tremendous run right up until basically up until COVID hit. And really the struggle has really been two things, COVID and then just before that, sort of the cutting the cord, which was affecting, right, some of their cable business. But otherwise, Disney was wildly successful before that. But, you know, they've done some pretty bold things. I think Disney Plus so far looks like it's been quite a success, right? I mean, they've got 100 million subscribers, so hard not to argue it's been successful so far. And they're doing some interesting things, like enabling people to basically, you know, have movies go direct to your home before they ever, you know, at the same time or before they go to the movie theater. So I think they are thinking differently. I mean, from the outside looking in, it looks like they are, you know, but I think, you know, we'll see what else they're going to have to innovate. I don't know. I worry about a solution, you know, like the subscription without knowing deeply what the customer need and desire is. Right. So I always counsel companies, don't go around with a hammer looking for a nail. So subscription-based companies, there's some of them that are wildly successful, Netflix, et cetera. Is that for everybody? Oh, that's not the way to think about it. The way to think about it is, what's the fundamental customer need you're trying to solve for? What's the desire? And then build a product that fills that need, right? And so subscription may be right for some companies, not others. I don't know because I haven't done the work at Disney to know. And that means the core skill is empathy. Being able to really stand in the shoes of customers and really understand their emotion, their needs, their wants, their pain points, et cetera. And then figuring out what's the solution for them. I think the danger in a lot of companies is they've got that hammer in search of a nail, right? So I don't know. I mean, Scott may know more than I do on that, but I would worry about just jumping to a solution without really understanding the customer and what they want at this time.
Yeah, it's a great point because I think innovating for the sake of innovation or being cool, you know, is sometimes not the right motives. Speaking of empathy for a second, there was this article that I came across. I'll ping it to you in a sec, but I'll talk you through it. But it was a release from Google specifically, and it's entitled Empathy is the Skill of the Future, according to Google. And it goes on to describe the role of empathy as in the context of leadership, but more broadly in the context of culture. And obviously culture being a key conduit to innovation, right? So if you have a culture that's kind of, you know, let's just say built on a fixed mindset, not on a growth mindset, it's kind of hard to sell innovation. Really to get that kind of embryonic spark to get something that's truly, you know, innovative to a new customer or even something innovative to the same customer base. Could you explain maybe more broadly in the context of leadership, its relationship in your experience to empathy? How do you see the role of empathy playing out, you know, in a business environment that's opening up post-pandemic where there's lots of now new opportunities everywhere? And if an entrepreneur was looking to pursue something new, how would you describe the role of empathy in unlocking new commercial opportunities for them?
So for me, it starts with, you know, what's a traditional way that we do market research? We survey lots of people. We love large N, right? We think, right, if we get lots of people to respond, that's a good thing. We'll have a lot of data. What's the problem with that? There's a simple problem with that, right? As Margaret Mead once said, what people say, what they say they will do, and what they actually do is really fundamentally different, right? So, you know, and it's the question I always say is, you know, your doctor asks you, how many alcoholic drinks do you consume on average per day? Who tells the truth, right? Who tells the truth, right? What they tell a doctor, what they actually do. So you have to get out there in the wild and observe people and interview them and see what they're doing. If you want to empathize, you can't ask them because they'll tell you what they think you want to hear, or they'll tell you how they think they ought to behave, right? Okay, so that's a core principle. In design thinking, that's a core principle. Get out there and, but here's the point I make. The bottom line is we're not very good at this. There's a bunch of sort of cognitive obstacles when we go out there. And the biggest one is we often go out there with our own preset beliefs about what we think the customer wants and needs. Because we've been in this business for a long time. We think the customer wants X, Y, Z. So we go out there, we think we're empathizing. We go out there and try to understand customer needs, but we're so shaded by, so clouded by what we already believe that we ask leading questions. We jump to conclusions that confirm what we already believe, right? So this is the challenge with empathy, is you have to be able to somehow shed what you think already and just really figure out what's going on there with the customer. And if you can do that, and the biggest thing to look for there is look for their pain points. Look for where they're frustrated. I always say, look for workarounds, right? Which is a workaround is like makeshift solutions the customer has employed, right? Because that's the customer screaming at you, your product sucks, and I had to invent a solution because your product didn't do the job for me, right? You know, why are people killing the environment by putting iced coffee inside of a big styrofoam cup? Well, because they don't like the condensation and the ice melts too fast, and you know, there's all these, and it's slippery, and so they stick it in, and it's terrible for the environment, but it's because your cup stinks. So they had to invent their own solution. Bingo, opportunities for innovation, right? These are the kinds of things we can look for. But I think it's being able to not let what you already believe cloud what you see that is the hardest empathy skill.
That's such a great point. I want to circle back to Apple for a second. There's a quote by Steve Jobs, and he said, you know, it's really hard to design products by focus groups. A lot of times people don't know what they want until you show it to them. I read his autobiography, I finished it probably a month ago. And what really struck me was, obviously everybody knows the Apple story and how one of the world's most amazing innovators he was. And obviously he passed, you know, 10 odd years ago. And one of the things that struck me was, I was like, what happened since? With Apple, do you know what I mean? Like the iPhone just completely, I mean, there were seven different industries that Steve was largely responsible for essentially disrupting completely. iTunes, you know, even Apple stores, etc. And obviously Apple's hugely profitable, right? One of the world's most successful companies ever. But if we're talking and looking at Apple specifically in innovation and we compare, well, the Steve Jobs era versus Steve Cook, What have you observed about Apple? Do you still point to Apple as a kind of a great practical real world reference today? And how would you characterize their rate of innovation now?
Well, I think there's two things to remember. One is to remember there's two kinds of innovation. There's sort of really transformative, radical innovation where you're busting out and breaking into a whole new category, and then there's incremental innovation, right? And you have to be able to do both. And this is challenging for companies, right? And so certainly Apple's continued to do a lot of great incremental innovation, right? They continue to refine and improve products that were created back in the Jobs era. On the more transformative stuff, they have done some things, but the iPhone is such a dominant business. The Apple Watch business, if it was a standalone business, would be an unbelievable entrepreneurial success, right? And we would go, wow, look how innovative. And that's post-Jobs, right? It looks like a speck on the income statement of Apple because of how big the iPhone business has become. But the watch has been a remarkably successful innovation. It's just, it's getting drowned out in a way. So it's hard to judge Apple because they've done some things, but they got this behemoth called the iPhone, which is so dominant overall that it makes the new things, you know, the new earbuds, you know, the AirPods that they created are a wildly successful new business. But, you know, who can see it in an income statement where the iPhone is just generating, you know, mountains of cash every single hour?
Yeah. And it just goes to show just how, you know, how incredible the iPhone still is to this day.
And look, the iPhone story is a really interesting one because if you go back, right, there's two really interesting parts of that story. One is the fact that it fully cannibalized the iPod, essentially, right? It basically destroyed one of the most profitable product lines in the history of the tech industry, the iPod. And that, a lot of companies, right, one of the barriers to innovation is they're so worried about cannibalizing their profitable cash cow that they resist bringing out a new product because they're like, wait, we're going to kill the golden goose with this new product, which is unproven. But Apple was willing to do it. They believed in the iPhone and they launched it and said, you know, it's going to kill the iPod, but better, even better things will come, right? And that's one part. The other part of the story is, you know, the initial reaction by people at Research in Motion who owned BlackBerry and by BlackBerry users at first, some were like, wait, you know, it doesn't have a keyboard. It has crappy battery life. This is the iPhone, the first iPhone. Mm-hmm. Crappy battery life, no keyboard. And how is it going to deal? It doesn't have enough security for corporations to adopt it. All those weaknesses were true of the first iPhone. Here's the thing that BlackBerry missed. But look what the phone could do, right? The phone could do all these other things that people really wanted, right? And it's amazing things it could do. Yeah, there were some things it couldn't do very well. But look what it could do, right? And we sometimes miss that in the innovation story, right? And I mean, go back to the beginning of Netflix. You know, to the person who was a core Blockbuster customer, right, who went to the store with their kids every Friday night to rent a movie, the original Netflix service looked like a crappy service. Wait, what? I got to get online, set up a queue. They're going to mail me a DVD by U.S. Postal Service, and then I'm going to mail it back. It's terrible. It looks like a terrible business. But there was a core group of sort of niche customers that were willing to adopt, right? I like to say they were the young men living in their mother's basement, right? Who were hardcore cult classic movie watchers. They got them to do it, and then they refined the hell out of that service. And then before Blockbuster knew where to hit them, suddenly the suburban moms and dads were using Netflix.
That's mad. I mean, one of the things I'd like to get into is this idea of organizational inertia, to your point. You know, you have shareholders, you know, it's difficult to really justify funding innovation or radical innovation, as you call it, or, you know, as Clayton Christensen might describe it as, you know, category-driven innovation potentially. And I think to your point earlier, I think as leaders, we often value creativity, but sometimes we lack frameworks, right, or creative frameworks to execute with. Could you maybe share an example of a framework that can be followed by our listeners and viewers around the world?
I think, well, here's one I think that, you know, to think about is think about this idea that when people have a new idea inside of a large organization, what will happen is they'll say, typically the question they'll receive very early on is, how big is your idea? What's the market opportunity? Size the market for me. This is the typical framework, right? Basically, predict the size of the opportunity because, look, we're a big company. We have $1 billion in revenue. If this is not a $500 million idea or a $50 million idea, whatever the number is, it won't move the needle, right? It won't move the needle. Therefore, we're not interested. Now, what's the flaw in that reasoning? The flaw in that reasoning is that if it's a really original idea and it's really early on, the likelihood that this innovator will be able to accurately predict the size of the market is very, very low, right? And I give a lot of examples in the book about how bad we are at predicting the future, right? Especially when it comes to really bold ideas. So we're asking this person to predict the future when it's not likely they're going to be able to do it. So now they're faced with two options. One is overpromise, and then if they underdeliver, you know, we slit their throat. Or they're realistic, and you tell them, it's not a big enough idea. So we have to rethink how we evaluate ideas in their early stages. We have to think about other metrics besides how big the market will be, right? We have to think about metrics around, you know, how passionate will a core group of customers be about this? Will they be willing to pay a price that will generate an attractive margin for it, right? So there's a series of other questions you ask about the sort of validity of the business before we get to the how big is the market. Stop worrying about whether it's going to move the top line of your large corporation and figure out whether it's an actually attractive idea. And that's around, is it desirable by customers? And then is it feasible technologically? And is it viable financially? If it does those three things, right, then the dollars will come, right? And the market may be bigger than you think. I use the example of Yeti coolers, which, you know, the Yeti brand has taken off. Well, I ask, imagine those entrepreneurs were part of a big corporation and they were asked, how big is your idea? When their original idea was the $700 coolers, right, for extreme hunters and fishermen who were going to be out in the wild for several weeks, right? The answer would have been the market for $700 coolers is tiny, right? And their idea would have been killed. Instead of thinking, wait, but is that really desirable by a core group of people? Attractive to a niche? Yes. Is it feasible? Yes, they had cool technology. And is it viable? Holy cow, we can generate really strong margins doing this. Okay, and then you ask, if we build a great brand with that small niche set of customers, could we extend that brand to the broader population? Oh, wow. Yes, we can, right? Now, I don't have one in front of me, but everybody's got their Yeti tumbler, which they pay $30 for, Matt, right? But you don't know that at the beginning, you know? So our framework should be about is it meeting a customer need in a financially viable way? Instead of worrying about, is it going to generate $50 million or $100 million in sales?
Yeah, I love what you said. And just to add to that, I think oftentimes we underestimate the impact that a Yeti cooler can have as a halo effect on all the other products that you offer. I mean, we as a company, we're doing this now. We're moving from a services, you know, revenue type business into a subscription sort of play. And so innovation is a very important thing for us, quote unquote innovation. But one thing we've observed is that, you know, as we introduce just a simple, slight nuance, it's not even a huge, like whole new different thing. It's the same thing packaged differently, essentially. But your ability to commercialize with existing customers is like you underestimate that. And I think customers, you know, you mentioned the word novelty. I think also we gravitate to the new. You know, if I've bought something from you, it's like even the new version of the iPhone, you went, okay, well, what's the new interface going to look like or what have you? But I think as leaders, sometimes we underestimate the impact that even a small sustainable type of innovation play, product or otherwise, can actually have on your business.
And sometimes innovation is not about a new product. It's about a new way, a new business model, right? And I think the other thing you asked about a framework, the other piece is you have to have a framework of experimentation that says instead of analyzing a problem to death and deliberating as to whether this is a good idea, you have to say, let the user decide. And the way you let the user decide is you conduct some experiments. And the example I'll give is Rent the Runway. You know, two young female Harvard Business School students come up with this idea of renting dresses. Right, renting these beautiful dresses. And they know, they kind of have an instinct and intuition that there's a customer need because they know friends who have gone and bought dresses, not taken the price tag off, worn them to an event, and then returned them, right, as if they had never worn them, right? So like, we know people are out there doing that. There's a workaround, a makeshift solution, right? Wonder if we could rent dresses. Instead of sitting there and building massive financial forecasts based on wild, unproven assumptions, what did they do? They ran a trunk show with some undergraduates at the college where they were at. And they said, will these young women rent dresses? Will they return them on time? And will they return them relatively undamaged? Sure enough, they would. Then they said, but we're not actually going to run trunk shows around the country where people can try these things on. Let's run another trunk show. Let's not let the young women try it on. Let's see if they're still willing to rent the dress. And they learned some things about what kinds of dresses people will rent and which ones they won't if they can't try them on. And then they said, one more test. Now we're not going to run a trunk show. Now we're just going to put PDFs up on a website. Now you can't even see the dress in person. Will you rent it? A lot fewer women rented, but enough that they thought they had a viable business model. So they experimented their way to a model that worked, right? As opposed to saying, let's sit in a room and argue over numbers that we're making them up. We have no idea how big this market is until we go out and see what the market is.
Yeah, it's such an important point because oftentimes your customer, when you start out, your customer is actually different when you have a successful commercial business. We did that. And in fact, pretty much outside of maybe a record label, all the big successful businesses that I had have learned a similar lesson in that, you know, follow the market and kind of, you know, iterate your way to, oh, okay, there's the gap. Because oftentimes I think if you might spot a gap in the market, but there might not be a market in the gap. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's lots of things you think, well, isn't that obvious that would work? Well, you have these assumptions you're making about consumer behavior. And one mark of a great experiment is you're testing assumptions that are critical to your idea. That if that assumption is not right, your idea might not work. Right. And ability to test that, you know, is so key. So, you know, and there's companies that do this, not just when they're starting out, but continuously. So Netflix is running experiments every day, right? A/B testing, where they are test. So the interface you're seeing, Matt, you don't even know it. You may be seeing an interface today on Netflix that is actually not the interface that most people are seeing. You might be part of an experimental group where they're showing you something different and testing to see if it affects your behavior and comparing it to the control group, which is the pre-existing interface that Netflix has. And they're doing that every day and experimenting on how they display content and what content they develop all the time. So this isn't just about when you launch. This is about how you operate going forward.
And didn't they offer, I think in their first early period, didn't they offer $1 million to anybody who could write a better algorithm?
They did. So that's another, you know, way you can innovate is through, so essentially crowdsourcing solutions, you know, through open innovation. And Netflix has done it. Other companies have done it, where you basically put out a challenge and see if someone out there can help you solve your problem better than you can. And you essentially tap into the wisdom of the crowd. Has to be carefully designed, right, to protect your intellectual property and the like. But it can be done, and lots of companies are doing that.
I just want to maybe change gears and talk about the work that you're doing at Harvard. Also on your Twitter, there was a webinar that you were on with essentially you were sharing your experiences with students. And I'm also fascinated about, obviously we all know education's kind of like defunct, right? It needs to be kind of upgraded, if you like. I think we all have a role as leaders to teach. But I'm fascinated to get your views on your experiences engaging with, you know, young, hungry, inexperienced minds who are interested in, you know, how to build the future sustainably, potentially. I just would like to get some general views from you in terms of teaching effectively. How does one as a leader today teach effectively, especially to, let's just say, millennials who are sometimes often difficult to manage?
Yeah, you know, you're referring to this. So I do a lot of work with Harvard Business Publishing, and we ran a webinar for instructors around the globe around engaging students and keeping them engaged. And there's some lessons there about engaging employees, I think, too, you know, very much. And I, you know, I started out with the Teddy Roosevelt quote, you know, people will only care about what you know if they know that you care. Right. And so I talk about the ways I build rapport and build relationships and build trust with my students. Because if I don't do that, if they don't know that I care, well, then they won't respond to the rigorous demands I put before them. I am going to challenge the heck out of them, right? I know I'm going to be giving them a fair, healthy dose of negative feedback over the course of the semester, right? I mean, they're going to be asked to revise things and resubmit them, and it's going to be challenging. So at a base, I've got to build that level of rapport and trust. So they got to care. That's really key. And then, you know, we have to use all the tools are at our disposal, whether it's technological tools or interpersonal tools, collaborative tools, to engage them in different ways, to take the same ideas and let them explore those ideas using in different ways, right? That's really important. I say in a session, an hour and 15 minute session, every 7 to 10 minutes, you should be changing the pace or the structure of your class. Because the young people's minds, they're not going to sit through and retain anything if they sit through a 45-minute lecture that's just flat. So that's got to be punctuated with some time for a little bit of small group collaboration, a video, you know, some little exercise you ask them to do on their own, right? And, you know, discussion and changing that pace to get them to not just to capture their attention, but what you're trying to do is inject learning by doing into the classroom. So they're not just passively receiving knowledge, but they're doing something and thereby learning. And of course, we know that's true about employees too, right? That they're not going to learn just by going to some class and being trained. They've got to learn by doing, you know, and this is so important. It's a great story about UPS years ago, the United Parcel Service, right? They have a very, very detailed set of protocols on what their drivers should do so as to most efficiently deliver their packages. And they would traditionally, they'd send people to classes, new drivers, a lot of classroom instruction, fairly dry, a lot of lectures about how to handle packages, how to pick them up, how to ring the doorbell. I mean, incredibly minute. They were losing people. Young people were bailing out before the classes were even done, never mind staying to work as a driver. What do? They said, we got to do this differently. And they basically built a mock-up of a little town main street inside a warehouse. And they create a learning by doing hands-on experience of how you learn to be a driver, as opposed to sitting in a classroom. Boom. People learn more. They retain young people more. They're more productive. Yeah. Mm.
And tell me, Professor, where do you see just general trends-wise, if you talk about higher education, how do you see things being disrupted? I mean, if you think about COVID driving a lot of online education now, one of the stories that I observed was the number of students who were canceling their Harvard grade educational, funds because of the cost. And I think parents also who were paying for their kids were like, well, hang on a second, why am I paying? How much money am I paying for online? I want you to be in classroom interacting with, Professor Michael Roberto, So with that being said, where do you see the educational system going, and what opportunities do you see for entrepreneurs who are looking to have a play in that space?
I think the biggest challenge for education is that, we're focused on sort of a process, right? Which is, the 4-year college experience. You go through, you take certain courses. Each time you do, you get a check mark. You can go on and take the next course. Each course is a semester long. Like, it's a very regimented sort of march through a curriculum, right? It's been this way for hundreds of years. I think today we're looking and saying, wait, it's really should be about learning outcomes, right? So if I can learn something as a student and prove that I've learned it in 3 weeks through an online module, why am I sitting through a 12-week class, right? If I can show mastery and I can do that, can I go on? Can I, so it's much more, I think we're having to shift and think about, wait, are we thinking about the students learning, or are we thinking about just what works because it's our structure, semester long, 3-credit course, march along. And what's happening, I think, is you're seeing that upper popping all of these, various certifications that people can earn outside of the university system to learn how to code or to learn how to, do other things. And those things are often, much more flexible, much more self-paced, and much more about proving you can do something. And then when you do, you get some credential, right, that you can use in the marketplace. And it's very market-driven. So that, I think, will be challenging for us as educators, that shift in mindset toward what are they learning versus, the process by which we traditionally have just delivered this thing called the diploma.
Yeah, I see you've got a son in the picture there behind you, right? Is that your son?
Yeah, I have 3 kids. So I have 2 in university right now, two daughters in university, one at Vanderbilt and the other at Villanova. And then I have a son who's still at home. So yeah, that's a picture when they were much younger. Yeah.
And what do you teach them that's potentially, in the context of our discussion, of course, around creativity, et cetera, and how to solve problems? What do you teach them potentially at home that you don't teach in the classroom?
That's a really good question. I try to take a lot of what I do to the classroom from what way I think about it. I mean, so I don't know that there's anything radically different about that. That's a really good question. I don't know. I think a lot of the things I tell my kids are things I tell my students. I treat my students as my kids. You know, I mean, I feel like they are in many ways, especially as I've gotten older and they are the age of my kids, right? So I don't think there's anything radically different there. You know, I do believe that, you know, being curious is such an important trait. And, you know, I think that I do talk about, you know, the more you develop expertise in an area, the less curious you sometimes become. So I tell them, be careful about that, you know, that's a danger. You should always be asking the questions like you did when you were 5 and 6 years old and asking, how come, why, you know, how does that work? That sort of trying to keep that as you grow older is so important. I do tell my children that. I've always told my children that. And that's a great trait. That curiosity is what often spurs innovation, and it often keeps us young as we grow older.
Yep, absolutely. I'm a big fan of being curious, hence why I do the podcast, right? So what's the best piece of professional advice you've ever been given?
Best piece of professional advice I've ever been given. You know, I think that was probably ingrained from my father at a young age, is I think the idea of making sure that you express your gratitude to the people who've helped you, and that, you know, recognizing that you're not doing it on your own. Whatever you accomplish, you're always accomplishing in part through the help, support, guidance of others, the contribution of others, and then making sure you thank them, you know, is so important, I think. We get into this trap sometimes, you know, if we're successful at something and thinking that we're the reason for our success and forgetting that there's all these other reasons for our success, right? That have to do with the support structure around us, the people around us. And a lot of times the reason people fail when they move from one venture to another, one job to another, is that they forget that all these other things that were in place that helped them succeed in their prior role, now they're off on a new role. They've lost that structure and, you know, how important that is. So that ability to be grateful for those things that helped you and recognize how important they were to your success is, I think, really important from a career standpoint.
Yeah. In my personal life, I attribute pretty much all my success to my wife. I'd like to tell a reminder of that, you know, and it's not just to pay lip service to that idea. It's actually to be, you know, very sincere about that also, in the sense that, you know, at least in my perspective, like, you know, you've got 3 kids, I've got 2 kids, and they're honestly the hardest job you'll ever have is being a parent, but they're also the greatest gift, and nothing worth having comes easy. It's like, if you do the things that are easy, life's hard, but if you do the hard things, life's kind of easy. But I hear you, and it is important to take stock of that journey, right? Because I love young entrepreneurs, you know, if they're like 26 years old and you tell him he's Jesus and he can walk on water, he'll believe you, you know? But as you grow older, you develop this empathy, right, for your journey and your story, and you start to reflect on all those things. And that's when you realize that actually you're not the center of the universe. It's actually everything to do with this, as you said, that support system that's around you. So I would like to say I appreciate you, Michael and Professor, for being on the show. It's been a real privilege having you here. I would just like to ask you one more question. Why do you do what you do? Like, what gets you out of bed in the morning?
Oh, it's a great question. You know, I'm very fortunate, Matt, in the sense that I tell students that, you know, Willie Mays, once said I would play this game for free, famous American baseball player. And I kind of feel like that about what I do. You know, I really love what I do. And for me, it is, there's many facets to my job, right? There's the teaching, the research, the consulting, the writing. I do a lot of different things. So the variety of things I do is something I get really jazzed up about. I'm not doing the same thing every day, which is cool. But the biggest thing is the personal impact, you know, that I have. And so whether you're a teacher, whether you're a manager, you know, whatever your job is, I think you think about it in terms of the personal impact. If you're a manager, it's that employee you coached and developed, and they got a big new opportunity because of it. It's a teacher. It's the helping a student figure out what they want to do with their life and land that job. That's what gets me jazzed the most. And then those great notes I get back from students who tell me about the impact. Sometimes I have no idea the impact I had on them based on some small conversation over coffee. That's kind of neat. And so I think sometimes we think a lot about, like, what's the purpose of our business? What are we trying to accomplish as a business? And that matters to employees. But purpose is also about, like, what do you do in day to day and what impact you have on others? And for me, that's really, you know, the key is that, can I have a positive impact on them and help them? And for me, it's largely about helping young people figure out what they want to do with their lives and then how to get there, right? What's the path? What are they going to have to do to get there? And if I can help them a little bit, that's so awesomely gratifying. It's the best thing in the world.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, one of the things I've learned is that a business is not actually about making money. It's about changing the lives of the employees that work with you in the business. At least that's my philosophy, because if you do that, they will take care of your business and it could be commercially, you know, successful, or it has a higher probability of doing that. But just to conclude, Professor, thank you so much for your time. It's been a real privilege to tell your story on the Matt Brown Show.
Thank you, Matt. Thanks for having me.
Cheers, mate. Bye now. Thanks for listening to the Matt Brown Show, guys. Don't forget, you can catch me on all social media platforms for the latest updates, news, and a show history. So if you've been catching this on the podcast, please head on over to our YouTube channel and pound that subscribe button. It would be great to catch the video version there. And if you want a free copy of my number one Amazon best-selling book, Your Inner Game, for free right now today, you can grab that on mattbrownshow.com/ebook. Ever wanted to become a best-selling author? Well, I'm in the influence business and I work with business owners and CEOs and business leaders to help them scale their influence. And we do this as a team by helping you to become a best-selling author, sought-after speaker, and industry influencer in only 30 days. My team and I have developed a system that delivers a best-selling book and a launch campaign 300% faster and 50% less cost than anyone else in North America. This system is incredibly efficient. One of my clients, Haiku, went from a 2% share of voice globally to an 11% share of voice globally in only 7 days. If you'd like more information, head on over to showworksmedia.com for more. That is showworks with an X.com.